This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State.
Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. Christian nationalists are attacking these fundamental freedoms. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/NYT.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your deeply unsatisfied and do-right source of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Think by Aretha Franklin. Aretha Franklin passed away. She died this week at 76. And on this week's podcast, we're going to pay tribute to the Queen of Soul and the Queen of very, very much more than that. First, I'm joined by, over the phone, John Prellis, Chief Pop Music Critic of the New York Times. Hey, John.
Hey there.
And in the studio, live and direct, in a beautiful blazer and lovely shoes, Wesley Morris, Critic at Large from the New York Times.
Hi, you guys.
First, we're going to talk about her musical legacy, and then later in the show, David Ritz, who is the definitive Aretha biographer, is going to call in and talk to us about the process of working with her over many years to get her story and the parts of it that she would give and the parts of it that she wouldn't give. Let's just right off the rip set the stage for Aretha's importance for our listeners who may not totally understand the scale of what Aretha achieved, especially in the 60s and 70s. Wesley, you and I were talking a little bit before that, you know, the deaths of Prince, you know, the more recent Michael Jackson, they were a little bit closer to the popular imagination at the time of their death. Mm-hmm. But we are a little bit further away in terms of Aretha. So can you set the stage a little bit for what she was able to achieve in the 60s and 70s that was so essential?
Well, for one thing, she just changed the way pop music sounded from the standpoint of what the singer was doing.
Exactly. Nothing major. Nothing big.
You know, I mean, I would say there were a handful of people who were responsible for the complete re-architecturing of what a popular song should sound
should
like.
Should be, yes.
You know, Ray Charles, Sam Cooke, Otis Redding. I would say Tina Turner and Patti LaBelle toward the end, like the middle and end of the 70s. But Aretha was just the most explosive sounding mm-hmm. of all those people. And the one who, you know, Tina Turner, I would say, probably had the decibel system.
There wasn't a decibel count at the time.
Would rate it. But I mean, Aretha was the one where when she sang, you also didn't have to worry about her personal safety mm-hmm. or anybody else's personal safety.
Right.
The other thing about her that was so important was her timing was perfect. Her switch from Columbia to Atlantic mm-hmm. happened at the exact right moment. Her going...
In terms of like what was happening in the rest of the world. Well, that's the country, certainly.
Yes.
JP, let's talk about that 67-68 period for Aretha. Because basically she'd been on Columbia for the first 5 or 6 years of her career. But the songs, the iconic, canonic Aretha stuff that we think of is very rarely from that period. It's all from the late 60s onward. So can you talk about what was happening at that time and why she was well-suited to that moment?
Well, I'm a boomer, I admit it. And the impact of hearing Aretha Franklin's voice leaping out of a bad little AM radio speaker in 1967 was just a revelation. People didn't sound like that. Music was not as funky as that. The whole combination of this voice that could go anywhere. And I don't think people gave Aretha, her voice was so great that I don't think people gave her enough credit for the grooves.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
If you go to Otis Redding's Respect, it's like, it's a 4-4 stomp. It's a great song. He kills it. But if you go to Aretha Franklin's perspective, it's this wild, syncopated thing where she starts on the weirdest note you would ever think she would start on, and she turns it into this crazy shape, and mm-hmm. she makes it, you know, straight to your heart. You read the contemporary accounts, Wexler, David Ritz talked to a lot of people. She walked into the studio with that stuff. She basically sang it to the Muscle Shoals guys. They had the chops to get it right, but it was her. Ritz interviewed Aris Mardin, the arranger, and arrangers love to take credit. Aris Mardin says, no, it was all Aretha.
And in those days, it's not like there's a credit on the 45 where it says arranged by Aretha Franklin. Like, that's not a thing that was happening at that time.
No, there's a producer credit.
Right.
And, you know, God bless Jerry Wexler, who got her to go down to Muscle Shoals in the first place and kept it together after their one day in Muscle Shoals, which ended in a drunken fist fight between her manager husband and the studio owner. Wexler then got the Muscle Shoals guys to come to New York, minus the guy that the fist fight started with, and record the rest of the album. But the concept was Aretha's. And all those years at Columbia, where she was doing supper club music and big bands, and let's have the string section and let's be schmaltzy, you know, all this stuff imposed on her, Wexler let her be herself. And she and her husband, who was helping with these bad decisions at Columbia, he got out of the way and let her be herself. So it's this moment of artistic realization, which syncs perfectly with 1967, the summer of love, the 60s, the civil rights movement, all this stuff. So you have this personal artistic moment coinciding with the societal moment, and it's just totally explosive.
Can we talk a little bit about the perception of Aretha as a political figure and performer in that time?
Mm-hmm.
She played every Martin Luther King benefit she mm-hmm. could. I mean, she was...
And her father was close to Dr. King, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, she was in it. She was in the civil rights movement. It's not like the rock stars do now and parachute in for a hunger benefit.
Right.
It's like Martin Luther King called and she's on the road and she goes and plays the Martin Luther King benefit. It's hard to imagine how fast things were moving in 1967, 68. There was all this ferment, and her songs were, even if they weren't protest songs, they just were the spirit of the times.
It's also important to remember, like, how young all these people were, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, I mean, Martin Luther King wanted her, like, her sound was new, she was young, and he was young, and he was like, I want this new, young, black sound to be a part of whatever this movement is, because this is the sound of the movement. I mean, it's funny because if you think about it, I mean, she had during that period basically what I would call two modes, right? Like the up-tempo mode and the assortment of slower songs. She could take a ballad and do so many different things with it, so that a ballad is just like, that is not even a term I would use to describe like the other half of Aretha's catalog. Mm-hmm. Although in the 70s and 80s, I would say she did more conventional ballads.
Right, but there wasn't a staidness to the...
She was not a balladeer.
Right.
Right?
Well, let's go back to the church. That's where it comes from. I mean, she was not singing pop ballads. She was turning pop songs into gospel hymns. I mean, she was doing the slow part of the gospel song where the voice goes all over the place and feels the spirit. And then she was doing the fast part of the gospel songs, which just drives home that chorus.
John, can you talk a little bit about just like what it was like to hear this stuff on the radio next to, I'm just going to pick next to the Mamas and the Papas.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean?
Shade.
No. I mean, but it just could not have sounded like, because, you know, for me, the great radio moments I've had, I mean, they're not embarrassing, but they're important. You know, Smells Like Teen Spirit, I will never forget the first time I heard that song on the radio, mm-hmm. ever. I kept searching the radio to hear it again,
mm-hmm.
like for about an hour.
Right, because it sounded so disruptive compared to everything
else. That's true, John. There wasn't a video yet, though.
Mm-hmm.
And the other song is You Ought to Know,
mm-hmm.
by Alanis Morissette. And like I can't imagine what my life would have been like.
Had you not in that exact moment been there to receive that.
Or what it must have been like for JP
mm-hmm.
and the rest of America to have this woman's voice like knock you out of your car or mm-hmm. off the subway.
Yeah, well, that's what it did. I have to say, 67, 68 were pretty golden moments for top 40. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously the Poppers weren't bad. You got the Doors, you got the Beatles, yep. you got the Stones. I mean, you got Motown, too, which was another place you could hear this, like, gospel comes to pop sound. But Motown was orderly. Mm-hmm. Aretha was anarchic. Aretha would do whatever she wanted and make the song work.
Let's listen to You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, which is from 1967.
I have to say, I love that song. I mean, you know, we all do. We're mm-hmm. human beings.
Yeah.
But Baby, I Love You, which is the song that was a massive hit, I think after You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, she does not waste your time with her up-tempo songs. There's a conciseness to her agenda in them.
But what's interesting about that is she doesn't waste your time, but she feels like she's in her own
luxuriating,
time.
Luxuriating, yeah.
Yeah, it's a strange, and I don't know if this is a trick of her arrangement or a trick of the production, but with the thing that I always admired about Aretha is in the song, it feels endless and mm-hmm. spacious and roomy. It feels like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
It feels like 20 minutes.
Respect is so short.
But it's 2.5 minutes.
Right.
But so much is happening, and you really can, like, wrap yourself inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I think, especially as pop music got obviously more processed and more mechanical, that's not a thing that anybody prioritizes. But very few people have the raw talent to achieve as much in such a short period of time as Aretha was able to achieve. And I don't mean like over 5 years or 10 years.
No.
I mean like over 2 minutes.
Yes.
And it's an emotional roller coaster too in those
mm-hmm.
songs. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's not a slogan. It's not a jingle. She's taking you to the heights and she's taking you to the abysses if she wants to.
In that moment, obviously Aretha's gospel background and sort of grounding is what's really erupting into the pop mainstream. How much of that was happening prior to Aretha?
Mm.
Well, there's Ray Charles.
Right.
I mean, Ray Charles invents soul music by making gospel secular.
Yes.
And so she was definitely following through on him, always acknowledged on her part. What Aretha also had simultaneously in a running parallel to the gospel was jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Because she knew all that stuff. She knew Dinah Washington. You know, she knew, I mean, Art Tatum used to come to the family house. She had jazz raising, too. So you have all of the spirit possession of gospel, and you have all of the nuance and precision of jazz. There's a lightness in Aretha's voice. I think it's one of the things you were saying, John, about how, you know, she seems to take all the time in the world. There's a lightness in her phrasing that's not out of her church, that's out of jazzing.
Interesting.
So you get both this wild improvisational where the spirit takes me, and you get this sort of scalloping delicacy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an amazing combination.
Her voice is officially classifiable. She was a mezzo soprano
mm-hmm.
and had a 4-octave range. Is that correct?
I don't know, but that sounds totally plausible.
But what does that really tell you?
It tells you nothing.
No. Right? I'm sure Natalie Cole also was a mezzo soprano with a 4-octave range.
Yeah.
Again, no shot to Natalie Cole.
No shot, no.
But Aretha was just, I mean, the human voice is amazing, but the thing is, like, the thing about Aretha's voice is that it just, it did a little bit of everything. And basically, she could sing everything, and sometimes in some songs, especially I would say when her voice wasn't as glorious as it was an instrument in the 1960s and 70s, it really was her singing everything at the same time.
Sure.
And not desperately. I mean, I actually think, and this is going to sound crazy, you guys.
Go in.
What if she was a better arranger
than
in the 80s?
Oh, wow.
What if she had been?
What if she was? I mean, okay. So you mean
better in the 80s than in the 60s?
I would say, okay, let me think about this, because it's not true, right? The 60s and 70s stuff, like,
is counterfactual. Right.
It's not true, but I like it.
The 60s and 70s, like the late 60s and like early to mid 70s arrangements. She also was giving you before and afters, because she covered a lot of people's songs.
She did.
So you really had a sense of what this song is supposed to sound like.
And then what it could
and
be,
then what happens
be done
when, to, like, to quote Aretha herself, when she Aretha-fies it or Aretha-izes it. Mm-hmm.
I think this is a place to play I Say a Little Prayer.
Yeah.
Okay, I was going to say that, Eleanor Rigby.
I Say a Little Prayer was a hit for Dionne Warwick. Aretha wanted to jump on it. She had an idea on it. Wexler said, no, don't do it. It's too soon. That's a perfect Dionne Warwick song. It's not made for your voice. Aretha goes, I got an idea. Trust me. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. And she does it. And she suddenly takes this ditty to become spiritual and sexy and everything in between.
Let's do this. Let's play a little bit of the Dionne version, and then we'll mix it into the Aretha version. Mm,
this is so mean.
And then it will become clear what Aretha-izing really is about.
We're sorry, Dionne. We're
true
really
story.
Sorry.
True story, but it had to be done.
The moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little prayer for you. Walk home in my hair now, and wondering what dress to wear now.
Given what we just heard, Wesley,
mm-hmm.
make your case for Aretha in the 80s. And again, we should identify some great Aretha moments in the 80s. Like, people
I would
don't
say
think
there
it.
Were many of them, though.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I think the albums actually hold together as albums in a way that is easy to overlook. But let's just talk a little bit more before we go into the 80s, just about, like, what the climate was like to just do covers during this period.
Sure.
Right? Because it just doesn't work this way anymore.
No.
Now people get litigious.
It's strange because as pop music construction has become more collaborative and more 20 hands in the pie, it's weirdly the ownership has become strangely more firm. Back then, a version of a song was like a suggestion. It was like, hey, here's my take on blank. And then 6 months later, somebody else would be like, oh, here's my take on blank. Right. And then some country singer 6 months after that would be like, oh, here's my take on blank.
Well, what happens now is that the production is the song.
Mm,
and so the song becomes more inseparable from its original version.
Yeah, you're right, John. John, do you have a story about Dionne Warwick's reaction to Aretha Franklin's version of Say a Little Prayer?
Do you have a story?
I have no story. I just can't imagine that she could have been happy.
But also, but to your point, wasn't it normalized enough as a practice that you kind of accept that after you've had your 6 month run on the charts, someone else might come along and watch you?
This is the part where I think I'm like looking to be corrected by history or facts, but like it seemed that seemed like express.
That's a shot.
Yes. It seemed like what is she doing with this song? Because I hear it and I hear something like I'm just speaking as Aretha. Like I can hear things in this song that are not being achieved in this arrangement. And I think I've got an arrangement that can bring something out of this song.
But do you think Otis felt that about Respect?
In Rich's book, Otis totally endorses Aretha's Respect. He says it's her song now.
He wasn't mad about it.
He wasn't mad.
Do you think the Beatles mad? Was Glenn Campbell mad?
I don't know. These are great questions.
Where you do a whole separate episode calling, finding out who
was
mad.
But she practiced covers as a kind of eminent domain, right? Like she she liked something and she was just going to do it. And I think that was her most experimental mode, actually, because all those covers didn't work. Like, her cover of Suzanne is quite bad. Mm. JP, if you disagree with the Suzanne...
I'm not saying a word.
but her cover of Suzanne is so bad that it's kind of ingenious because it's so... Like, she takes the thing about Suzanne that makes Suzanne great
and eliminates
none
it.
Of it is in the song. Yeah. It's a totally different song. Mm-hmm. And it just makes me so desperate to really know, to be Aretha enough to just be able to hear music the way she heard it? Because we don't hear music the way she hears music.
But do you think, and it's interesting, because maybe you're right about Dion being mad, but...
I don't know.
You don't know.
I would be.
But also, I've got to imagine in this era, in the moment, contemporaneous, there must have been a popular understanding that what Aretha did and how Aretha did it was so kind of sui generis and so operating on a different level that can you actually even be mad? It's not like Aretha did the song in a way that Dion could have done it.
That's fair.
But chose not to do it.
Yeah.
It wasn't within her reach. So you look at Aretha and you're like, well, I can do that. Yeah. So maybe I'm not. Now, of course, did she outright steal it from my mouth? Yes, she took the food out of my mouth. Yes, of course. But you couldn't do it. So maybe you just had to be like a good sport about it and go back and record some more ballads.
I don't know how much that stands up in the court of even musical law.
I don't know.
I hear that.
Just an idea.
The other thing is, JP, she was kind of a mashup artist. One of my favorite things about Aretha is you could be listening to one song and then you could be listening to her do like The Thrill Is Gone. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden she's singing, Thank God Almighty, I'm Free at Last. Mm-hmm.
That's Nightclub. That's your era of Nightclub.
So that's jazz and cabaret.
That's what we call a medley.
Yeah.
Back in the day. And I had to think Apollo or at a nightclub in that era would have included the impressions of other singers. Often still does.
You mean even for someone as accomplished as her?
Yeah, Aretha said, this is how Jackie Wilson would have sung it. I've seen so many shows like this where the middle of the thing is just separating yourself from all of your idols by proving that you could do what they would have done. I'm going to sing this song like Jackie Wilson. I'm going to sing this song like Sam.
That's
Cook.
So generationally, like generationally specific. Because I can't imagine going to like a contemporary pop or R&B or hip hop show and be like, I can't imagine going to Drake show and him being like, here's how Public Enemy would have done it.
but would he drop in a quote?
I'm not even sure.
Right.
I mean, it's obviously the ecosystem of how that kind of stuff works in hip hop is different, but it's so interesting. Is that because of sort of like the traveling review aspect of the age of the era rather?
It's ancestor worship. It's really deep in African and African American music. You pay tribute to where it came from. You show the lineage. It was never my favorite part of the show, but it was always kind of fascinating.
Interesting.
To see, to separate your personal idiom from what you could have done. I think sometimes about all those people who do Aretha songs on voice competition shows, on those reality shows.
Yeah.
They hit every note she hits, right? They read the transcription. They've sung along. Whatever. There's nothing. There's no soul in it. There's nothing. It's not Aretha just flying around the stratosphere. It's just a bunch of notes.
Yep.
And it shows you how odd and eccentric her timing and choices and where she's going to hit the harmony and how she's going to slide into or out of the note. But the song isn't there because it's not Aretha. that was the magic of her. That was, or the transcendence of her. You know, that was what made her so startling end to end. I mean, even in her last years when she's covering Adele songs,
yeah.
You know, you still never know what she's going to do.
I was hoping to get to that later, but let's just throw in a little bit of the Aretha's Rolling in the Deep cover.
Mm.
Just because.
Because it's good.
Yeah, I mean, very simply.
And it's bringing me out of the dark. Finally, I can see it crystal clear. Go ahead and sell me out, and I'll lay your ship bare. See how I will leave with every part of you. Don't underestimate the things that I will do. I've got a fire burning in my heart, reaching a fevered pitch, and it's bringing me out of the dark. The scars I'm gonna love remind me of us. It keeps me thinking we almost had it all. The scars of your love keeps me breathless. I can't help thinking we could have had it all. Rolling in the deep. You had my heart inside your hand, but you played.
Let's go back to the 70s for a minute, because we have yet to arrive at the 80s for Wesley's hottest of hot takes. So two things are happening in the 70s. One is that Aretha is becoming less commercially successful towards the end of the decade, and that's also happening at the same time as the rise of disco and sort of forms of R&B that don't privilege the voice in exactly the same way as the style of soul that she excelled at. During that time period, and before we get to the 80s, Luther Vandross period and whatnot, what is happening in soul music, and how is the sort of post-Aretha peak moment being processed?
Disco killed a lot of soul singers. Mm-hmm. I mean, disco just knocked them off the map, the charts, the universe. There are some great vocal performances in disco, Gloria Gaynor, Donna Summer, but they're more about finding a mood and keeping it and writing it. Whereas Aretha starts you in one part of a drama and ends you somewhere else.
Yep. Yep.
Disco is very circular. That was one of her achievements. You know, people don't have 5 decades careers. People are in sync with fashion and then they're not. And Aretha went in and out a number of times, more than most. I mean, that's one of the things that was amazing about her was her survival skills.
We do forget that, because I think right now careers are obviously generally shorter and the arc is much more obvious. There's very rarely 3 peaks or 4 peaks.
But I actually think that a part of Aretha that makes her special too is there is always something really hungry about her. I never got a sense that she was resting on her Aretha-ness.
Interesting.
You know what I mean? I don't ever think that she got to the second half of the 70s and was like, you know what? I'm Aretha, God damn it.
Mm-hmm.
What, like, get up.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, no, I'm A, not going to do a disco record.
Right.
But I'm also not going to stop trying to make music that makes me
on
happy,
her terms.
On my terms.
Yeah.
And.
But is that her most memorable music?
The 70s?
The late 70s stuff?
No, right. No. I mean, there are a couple really good songs from that period. But the last great thing that she did in the 70s was the Sparkle soundtrack.
Yes, yeah,
which I
Curtis
mean
Mayfield.
Is just like it was at 7 or 8 songs of just pure. They're just perfect. Like each and every one of those songs is perfect. The way she goes out at the end of Sparkle, which is the opening song on that soundtrack, where she's just like it. Sorry, Aretha.
Should we play some of that? But no, we have the vocal doppelganger here, so we're good.
No, we should just play Aretha doing it.
Yeah.
This podcast is supported by Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life, a podcast that asks, how do we build a radically inclusive, thriving, multiracial democracy? Longtime equity advocate Angela Glover-Blackwell looks at movement, struggle, and progress in Los Angeles to see what it can teach the nation about building a democracy that represents everyone. Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm David Marchese.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro.
And we're the hosts of The Interview from The New York Times.
David and I have spent our careers interviewing some of the most interesting and influential people in the world.
Which means we know when to ask tough questions and when to just sit back and listen.
And now we've teamed up to have these conversations every week. We'll try to reveal something about the people shaping our world.
And we'll get some great stories from them, too.
It's The Interview from The New York Times. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It just takes a lot of self-understanding about how to sing to just end a song that way. And it's natural. It's just like it's part of the I mean, I don't know if that's the crescendo, like that's the dismount, right?
Yeah.
And she just rides it out. It's like a wave that's sort of coming into shore and she's just like hopping off her surfboard. I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
And so many times she... Like her, she is there for the whole song. I guess this is a thing that separates like her class of singers from another class of singers, where like a lot of singers who've learned the wrong lessons from her and Gladys Knight and a couple other singers is that they just want to go for the chill parts, you know, for the things that are going to pimple your skin.
Mm-hmm.
But Aretha was there at the beginning of a song.
Mm-hmm.
She was there in the middle of a song.
Mm-hmm.
And she loved the ends, especially, I would say, especially in the 1980s,
mm-hmm.
Where, like, all of her great songs were, like, mostly end.
Mm-hmm. They were end from the beginning.
Right. But she figured out, I mean, the thing that I guess my point about the 80s is just that, not that the arrangements are better than the 60s and 70s, but this was a person who had to figure out a way to sing the music of that period in a way that's authentic to her.
But also to the time. Yeah.
Right.
Coming off of the late 70s, where Aretha is less of a force in the charts because of disco and because of her kind of retreat to deal with family stuff. In the 80s, she's back. She's working with younger producers and she's doing kind of like a post-disco, proto, mildly electric R&B sound.
She's doing the kind of 80s pop that also brought Tina Turner back.
Yes.
You know, with big MTV-ready synthesizer-using productions. I mean, the turning point is Jump to It, the Luther Vandross-produced album,
mm-hmm.
which tries to do both sides, which has like a modern, cool rhythm track, Jump to It itself, but also goes back to, just in case you forgot that she was out in the 60s, it's your thing.
And let's keep in mind, Aretha is in her 40s now mm-hmm. at this time.
Mm-hmm.
She turns 40 in the same year that this album comes out. And for the next 4 or 5 years, she's still making albums that are pop viable with a number of significant hits.
They're selling. Yeah. They're charting high.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe videos on MTV,
Freeway of Love.
Yeah,
Freeway of Love. And I knew you were waiting, but yep. Freeway of Love, I remember seeing that.
That's probably my first Aretha exposure, if I'm being honest. And then I worked backwards.
Yeah, Freeway of Love. Yeah. I mean, for you and me, that would have been the first time we would have at least seen her.
Yeah,
I had heard her.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never seen her move before.
That middle period, when we think of the records you mentioned, I Knew You Were Waiting, a collaboration with George Michael. George Michael, depending who you ask, potentially an under-heralded soul voice of the 1980s. Because I remember that track, at least in my corner of the world, it was met with some skepticism as far as like, could he get on a song with her?
Oh, interesting. I don't know, because you know, it's really interesting to think about it that way. At the time, it was just a song with this guy I really liked and this woman that I really liked.
Mm-hmm.
But you hear it now, and this is the thing about listening to these 80s records, because you kind of I think because the 60s and 70s stuff is so unimpeachably great, you tend to sort of write off not only the songs from the 80s that she's doing, but her singing in these songs.
Mm-hmm.
And there are just some really eccentric choices that she is making in these songs. She does a cover of You Can't Always Get What You Want that's on, I think it's on Love All the Hurt Away, which is from 81. And somewhere in that song, she takes it and she turns, like, what to me has always struck me as like a cathedral song, you know, like the sort of opening with the choir that the Stones have in that song, and the tempo, which isn't really, I mean, tempo seems strong for the way that song operates, but she basically takes it to a Baptist church.
Right.
And it sounds like a chastisement when she sings You Can't Always Get What You Want.
I saw him today at the reception.
Think that there is something about the nature of the production of these 80s records that kind of, I don't want to say that the sense of abandon in the late 60s and early 70s songs is missing from these, but there is sort of like, I don't know if it's compression or like the high end is sort of not as spacious. There is something slightly more contained about these songs. Not that the vocals aren't great, but there's something more contained about them.
Well, it's everything about the 80s production. It's click tracks. It's flying things in. It's using the same backup track for verse three as verse one. It's all of the shortcuts or mechanization that came in. I mean, it's all a machine. I mean, it wasn't like standing in front of your band in the studio and running the take. But I think it was also you could deliberate so much more endlessly over how to do a song. It did suck a lot of the spontaneity out of a lot of 80s production.
But JP, what about, like, you're totally right about that, but what about on a song like Freeway of Love, which you know, there's a radio version, which I don't know when it ends, but it just ends, I think it just kind of fades out.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's like an extended mix that goes on for about 2.5 minutes. And it's Aretha basically treating whatever these instruments are as a band. And she has arranged with her backing singers like just so many different levels of how to just reinterpret the word free.
Absolutely. And, yeah, no one's going to stop her.
Right.
Everything she can for as long as she can. Every time she's an artistic dip, she goes and makes a gospel album and rebounds. It's her well. It's the perpetually replenishing well of her music. I think the backup of Freeway of Love is still pretty mechanical, but she's not going to let it be, not with her backup singers.
Can I pivot to Aretha as national treasure?
Uh-huh.
Because I do think for the last 10 or 15 years, what you've seen of Aretha or heard of Aretha has not necessarily been on albums or on the radio, but it's in these sort of iconic moments that are often, you know, they're televised, they're captured on video, they're mostly on YouTube, singing at inauguration, singing at award ceremonies, things of that nature. Can we talk about the presence of Aretha? First of all, I'm curious, have you seen Aretha perform live?
No, I never saw Aretha perform live.
Oh, Wesley, of course.
I know.
I got
and
to see
the
her
people
last...
I've seen live, you better believe I'm sorry.
I did get to see her last year, and I was really grateful to do that. JP, can you talk a little bit about Aretha live and sort of Aretha as kind of like an iconic physical presence?
Well, you were either delighted or appalled by her fashion sense. She was always vividly dressed.
Shimmying the fur coat off, like doing the do.
Yeah, or this time I went saw her in this like green thing with all kinds of like points and flounces that looked to me like a salad.
JP coming in on his Kathy Horn and Vanessa Friedman.
Every
right
Negro
now.
Knows that she was a little bit like your aunt, like drunk on church. Everybody, we all knew.
But that's fine. I mean, it was like you did not forget that dress.
No.
But before you talk about the inaugurations and you know Kennedy Center's honors, all that stuff, mm-hmm. I want to go back to VH1 Divas.
Okay.
Oh yeah, you mentioned that in your great obituary, by the way.
Because it was I was actually in the room for that.
Okay.
And Aretha was intensely competitive. Mm-hmm. You could tell. You could just tell. And so you would bring up one star after another, and then they'd get there like, I'm doing my best, I'm standing next to Aretha. They'd get that verse in, and then Aretha would just like do a Benihana job of it, just like
just vanquishing, like Mortal Kombat. Just
finish her.
Yeah, exactly. I mean that stuff's still floating around YouTube. You can just see them getting shredded and just, you know, of course there's a hug at the end or whatever, but they are slinking off in defeat. It was one of the best shows I ever saw.
Wait, but can you just set that up a little bit? Like, I mean...
So who else is there? Yeah, explain...
That was Celine.
Mariah, I think?
Mariah was that year.
Rod Stewart.
Well, that's, you know...
I mean, Rod Stewart was reduced to this, like, pitiful mewling. You could just see them all bowing to the queen. And it wasn't one of these like cooperative, we're going to share. It was like, if you step on stage with me, I'm going to cut you. I mean, it was a cutting contest in the very classic jazz sense.
I'm looking. Gloria Estefan is here. No shot, no cap, but I don't think Gloria Estefan.
But it's just like, I think
this.
That there's a way. The problem that I always had with Divas Live as a concept was the branding of these women and Rod Stewart as divas just never felt good to me because it kind of sold short the virtues of each. Like it sells the virtues of a Gloria Estefan short. Gloria Estefan's like excellence has nothing to do with Aretha Franklin.
Of course.
And so the idea that you would, I mean, even what Celine Dion does, while Celine Dion would probably be the first person to say Aretha Franklin, my number one
inspiration,
biggest inspiration. Nobody, it's hard to put, how do you put it this way? Like, what I want from Celine Dion has nothing to do with what I want from Aretha Franklin.
But to be fair, who could have been on that stage that could have genuinely been in dialogue with Aretha?
Zero people.
That's what I'm saying. Well, so like you gotta start with the B-list. Well, I guess Mariah.
But who are the fools? Like, I just wouldn't.
If
I'm Mariah Carey, I'm like, you know what? It's Aretha. I'm not going anywhere near that.
And I think in later years.
But they all do.
But also, you got to understand, at that moment, if I'm not mistaken, that's the first Divas.
It's the first or second one.
So it's not kind of an understood format. It's new. It's novel. So people are like, they want to show up.
Share the stage with Aretha.
We're going to show up for it. Right. But I think later, if they had done that 3 years later, I think people would have been like, you know what? I'm going to be in Fargo, North Dakota that day.
Right, playing a county fair.
Or I'll go, but just don't ask me and Shania Twain to stand on stage with Tina Turner.
Wow.
Just don't ask me to do it.
I didn't know Shania was going to catch a stray today.
But she was one of the divas.
I know. She's catching a stray. She caught up more than a stray that day. I'll tell you that.
Let's go back a second, though, because one of Aretha's survival modes in the 80s was to do duets with current stars.
Yes.
That was one of the things that Clive Davis was kept pushing her to do. She did the Eurythmics duo. She did the George Michael duo. This is like, okay, this isn't like when you put two people on the double bill because your first one's not going to sell at the arena. But instead of, you know, her being propped up by whatever the current star was at the time, she always outshone them.
So if we're going to talk about these duets, there are three that are meaningful to me.
Okay.
I Knew You Were Waiting. Major. Is a great song. Is a great song.
Major
and
vibe.
The two of them are great together. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it was recorded, but they sound in dialogue with each other. Mm-hmm. And she brings something convincing out in him. Something true.
Yes, and something that, and again, when I think back to that moment, something that was had not always been 100% abundantly clear prior to that.
Right, but this was around the time that faith was becoming a thing. So, like, we were all still learning about this iteration of George Michael.
Exactly.
The other duet that I think is great, and this is less popular, but it's Through the Storm, a song she sings with Elton John. Mm. It's a very well-written song, and it's perfectly produced and arranged to suit what's great about him as a singer and what's evidently great about Aretha Franklin as a singer. And the third one is It Isn't, It Wasn't, It Ain't Never Gonna Be.
Is this the Whitney?
This is the Whitney duet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
is that the only Whitney Aretha?
That I know of, it's the only one.
Yeah, I don't think there are any others.
And the two of them, I don't want to say it's a fight. The way the song works, it is a fight between the two singers.
Right.
Or disagreement. And they play that. I love the sort of mock combativeness.
What makes you think it's mock?
Yeah, Whitney's like, I'm going to get you back for what you did to my aunt.
Oh,
we'll say a little prayer.
The long con.
Yeah.
The longest con.
You know, but Sissy, Whitney's mother, was in Sweet Inspiration. Sissy was Aretha's backup.
Yes, thing. Right. To circle back to what we were talking about a moment ago about her kind of as kind of the national treasure era. The thing that I always am struck by is when artists get to a certain stage in their career and they're kind of like rolled out at these big events, often it's very underwhelming, right?
Yes.
Like it's very much like everything is a shadow of the former self. It's there to kind of trigger nostalgia, but very rarely are they delivering iconic performances or strong performances. And I like that Aretha kind of disrupts that narrative
because
almost every time you see her, she's exploding something.
Right.
Even in these spaces that are not designed for explosion. So when you think of whether it's the inauguration performance, or are there sort of recent public moments that stick in your guys' minds as significant and essential parts of the Aretha canon?
Well, Wesley, you were saying the drop the mink moment. I think that was Kennedy Center Honors, where she's singing the Carole King tribute.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. I've just never experienced anything like that before in my life, where you just aren't. Well, no, I think the 98 Grammys is more explosive in terms of the doubt that she probably was up against from everybody in terms of who they knew she was going to be singing for, what they knew she was going to be singing. And the fact that, you know, at that point, she would have been in her 50s doing this song. And we just don't know anything about old women who can sing at this point.
Mm-hmm.
We just have never really experienced, like, a woman who meant that much to American culture still continuing to matter.
Yeah.
So she goes out there. I'll never forget it because I was like, I'm going to turn the channel because I can't watch this.
Nah.
But I was like, Wesley, it's Aretha.
Just sit.
So I watched. I mean,
dutiful.
And like
be
everybody
dutiful.
Else, I was like, are you kidding me? This woman, I don't, they're
snatched.
Yeah. Yeah. What about you, John?
I'm sorry that you never got to see the whole dynamic of a concert of hers, because there was always this feeling that she was imperious. Mm. She would do anything she wanted. Mm-hmm. If she was going to stop a song in the middle, if she was going to vamp it for another 5 minutes, you could see her musicians looking on in terror. in a good way, in a like edge of your seats, like, what's she going to do? I've got to keep up. Who knows? Maybe they got fined if they screwed up.
She wasn't James Brown.
she had some of that stuff going on.
Okay. Well, that's fair.
She would do what she wanted. If she decided that the groove was hitting on a song, she would stretch it out. If she, you know, wanted to change up and go suddenly from an up-tempo thing to a ballad, bing, it was done. There was also this feeling that what Aretha wants to do, she will do.
That was true. Even when I saw her last year, I mean, it was a very short show, but I was very prepared to not be surprised, basically, mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. essence. Mm-hmm. But even within 30 or 40 minutes, I was like, oh, like she's still, like, we're still like, we're fixing it on the go.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
You know, like it's alive. It's alive in the room.
Yeah.
And that's just not something that I feel generally at like 98% of the concerts I go to say nothing of people who've been doing it for six decades, you know?
She could have phoned it in. She did not phone it in.
No. Well, look, guys, thanks so much for coming and talking today. Wesley Morris, John Pareles, appreciate you.
Thank you, John. See you, JP.
See ya. What you want?
We're back. It's part two of the podcast. David Ritz is calling in from Los Angeles. Appreciate your time today.
I'm happy to do it or unhappy to do it.
Exactly. So you've written two books about Aretha, two very different kinds of books. You wrote From These Roots and then you wrote Respect. And for those who don't know, the first of those books, which came out, I believe, in the late 90s, is the Authorized book. And then the 2014 book is the Here's the Real Story book. That's a fair assessment?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't characterize my book as the real story. I mean, it's sort of my version. I think everyone has their own versions. I don't believe in, you know, the truth.
Sure.
I kind of believe in a truth, a version. So I wouldn't give myself that much credit. It's very subjective on my part. I mean,
you were telling stories that Aretha did not want told.
Yeah, I was telling stories she didn't want told, but I was also, just to put it all in context, you know, I look at myself primarily as a ghost, and I enjoy ghosting, and I love it, and so forth. So after I did the book with Ray Charles, the next book I wanted to do was hers, and he introduced me to her, but she didn't have any interest, so I chased her for about 20 years. I would send her postcards, and I'd use all my influence to try to get an interview, and I just never could. And then one day I was in Detroit, and she called me, and she said, let's talk, and we talked, and I talked her into it, and we did a book. And, you know, I was jumping up and down for joy. And we worked together a couple of years and blah, blah, blah. But we didn't get to what I thought was the essence of her complexity. And so a ghost writer never has editorial control. Ghost writer has editorial influence, but no control. And so the book came out and I kind of chilled and went away for 13 or 14 years. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, I knew her brother well. I knew her main producers, John Hammond and Jerry Wexler and Luther Vandross and Michael Norton. You know, I just knew the whole cast of characters. And I got to do my own book on her and have them in there telling
their versions,
their stories, as well as my overall interpretation.
During the process of the first book, was there active tussling or disagreement between you and Aretha about what could go and what couldn't go?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What were the things that she was particularly sensitive about or unsteady about in terms of wanting to be public?
I would say the main thing is because she's a product of the golden age of gospel and is primarily a gospel singer and was born in the church, you know, just there's always this optimism and praise and worship and glory to God. And at the same time, she's got the blues. I mean, she's really got the blues. And the blues is no joke. And so both the blues and the gospel are in her voice. You feel this pain and joy all at the same time. One doesn't undercut the other. They're all there together. She didn't want to talk about the blues. She didn't think she had the blues.
That's interesting.
I wanted her to sing the blues in her book. And her answer was, there isn't any blues.
So is it that she didn't conceptualize herself in the blues tradition?
No, I think she understood. I mean, we would definitely listen to, you know, Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith and Dinah Washington, and she loved them and appreciated them. I think what it is, you know, we all have strategies for emotional survival. And her strategy for emotional survival was idealization. Her dad was the greatest dad in the world. Her childhood was happy and carefree. And so if you look at her press clippings over whatever, you know, 50 or 55 years, right, when she's talking to jet bags, everything's great. She just got a new guy, and he's the most wonderful guy in the world, and she's going to open a club in downtown Detroit, and she's going to produce her biopic. And so it's and ultimately I had to respect that. I mean, because that was how she got through. I mean, she was an optimist.
The process of ghostwriting, which maybe some people who listen aren't totally familiar with, but the parallels between that and the journalistic process, there's a lot going on there. And often I think about the stories I know and can publish versus the stories I know but can't publish for whatever reason, because they've been told to me off the record or because you know them kind of second or third hand.
Exactly.
But I think your decision to go back and basically revisit the story, to me, says the essential quality of those stories to understanding Aretha as a figure outweighed any sort of lingering sense of loyalty to the process of 15 years prior.
Well, there's a couple of things there. Number one, she's too important an artist.
She's a titan. She's the titan.
Yeah, I mean, she's just like, you know, the queen of soul, and is the queen of soul is the queen of soul. So, and also she's a genius. And I've worked with, I think, a couple of other geniuses, but it's hard to negotiate genius. And when you have this electricity charging through you, when you have these ideas coming out of your head, because of the grandeur of her art and her place in history, I kind of felt like, man, if I don't do this book, who's going to do it?
Yeah.
And it isn't that people won't come after me and do their books, and I hope they will, and I'm happy to help them do their books, because I, you know, like I said, my version is a version. But because I was so close to her and I entered her intimate world, I felt I had a historical obligation. The other thing is this: the other books I did before that, you know, B.B. King or Ray Charles or Marvin Gaye, I always felt as though I got the story. Now, those stories weren't perfect, and every artist does leave out different things, but I kind of thought my gift as a ghostwriter, to a degree, is getting the goods and getting the essence of the funk. So I had no regrets about my book with Ray Charles, for example, even though he didn't tell me everything. And I certainly felt that same way about Etta James and, you know, a whole bunch of people that I work with. In her case, I felt like I left the story on the table. And so that's really the only time in my career where I felt as though there's an incredibly important story here.
And it's being left, right, and it's being left on the table if
I
don't
do it. I just have to tell it. And it was painful for me because I knew she'd be angry, and I really loved her and understood her, I thought. And I'm extremely uncomfortable when people are angry at me. I don't want anybody angry at me, but I thought, what the hell? I mean, history is history, and she is who she is. So anyway.
You talked about her self-presentation as kind of a form of coping, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can we talk about that in a little more detail in both a personal context, but also in maybe the context of the social politics of the era? Because being Aretha in the 60s didn't just mean being a titanic figure in soul music and in popular culture. It meant being political. It meant, you know, inserting herself into the controversy of the day. And I've got to imagine some of that when it came to her later years reluctances or reticence, maybe is there a larger connection to be drawn from how she had to be in that era versus how she chose to present later?
You know, one of the things that I think is that to have a black queen in the in the United States of America in 1967, it's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a big deal. There, you know. And, you know, in 1967 at the Regal Theater in Chicago, when the DJ Purvis Bluesman Span crowned her the Queen of Soul, you know, she put the crown on and she held it until she died. I mean, and so her queendom is a big deal. And it's a big deal not only because it changes her character, it gives her a kind of haughtiness and a dignity and a confidence and a public posture that she never had before. But it's important because she becomes an avatar. I mean, she becomes this, along with probably Nina Simone, she becomes an extremely independent, powerful Black woman at a critical time in our history.
We take for granted in this moment the sort of grand scale of Aretha's career and her talent and her level of success. But I would say in its day, maybe the story was slightly more complicated than that.
Yeah, it was more complicated because, you know, she was signed by John Hammond, who had discovered Billie Holiday and signed Bob Dylan and Springsteen. You know, I mean, this is a legendary, you know, it's like if you want to be signed by anybody, you want to be signed by John Hammond. And he really didn't know what to do with her. And though there are beautiful, beautiful cuts during her 6 years on Columbia, a version of Skylark, it's, you know, absolutely breathtaking. So it isn't that she didn't, she was great. So she was always going to turn out great versions, but there were no major hits. And the irony of all this is Columbia gave her mainstream material to try to give her a mainstream audience. When she went to Atlantic Records in 1967, the producer Jerry Wexler had her do non-mainstream material, which is to say gospel-y, R&B-ish material, and that got her the mainstream audience. He crossed her over with non-crossover material because of the tenor of the times. And that was the golden age of soul.
You talked a little bit about Aretha putting on the crown and basically not taking it off for the next four decades, basically. How much of that was external pressure and having to live up to the sort of legend of Aretha Franklin? How much of that was that kind of self-protective impulse that you were talking about?
I think she sort of dug it. I mean, I know that she liked being the queen. And now, again, the queen only has to talk when the queen wants to talk. The queen sort of maintains a distance from her subjects. And I think being the queen enabled her to do that. And privacy was incredibly important to her. She used it very skillfully. She kind of used her queendom to ensure the kind of privacy that was important to her. Now, given the crazy kind of media thing in this crazy country, she couldn't always pull it off. In other words, her goal was to control the sort of story. And she could do that to a large degree by telling Jet Magazine or whoever
yes.
that everything was great.
Great.
But for example, she had her first child when she was 12, and she had her just a couple of months before she was 13. Mm-hmm. She had her second child just a couple of months before she was 15. Now, you can't change that story.
Right.
And it seems to me that story is incredibly important and requires empathy and understanding. But when she told that story, it was like, yeah, I mean, my father was cool with it, and my grandmother helped raise my children, and it was, or her first marriage to Ted White, you know, and there was, you know, physical abuse that was witnessed by people, and mm-hmm. that got in the press, and then when she was first put on the cover of Time, when her hits first broke, I think the Time cover was either 67 or 68, she was infuriated with that story because it told some of those things that are
right.
that she had the blues, that she had a hard childhood. And so from that time on, her propensity or her need to control this sort of narrative became more and more important to her and became harder to do.
Sometimes I think a talent can be so singular and so specific that in a perverse way, their influence isn't as broad as maybe it otherwise been, because it's almost impossible. I felt this about Whitney a lot, where you couldn't possibly do Whitney after Whitney. It just wasn't the thing. So there's not as much kind of like faux Whitney or Whitney imitation or Monkey Whitney. Can you talk about Aretha in that context? As I'm curious what you think her legacy is, and in which ways maybe what she brought was so specific to her that it was hard to kind of emulate or version upon.
Well, interestingly enough, it's a little bit like Charlie Parker or Marvin Gaye. When Charlie Parker was alive, every alto player in the world wanted to play like Charlie Parker, and today the influences is powerful as ever because he was such a gigantic kind of figure. Same story of Coltrane. Marvin Gaye had that kind of thing where today I can name you a dozen current R&B singers who are the children of Marvin Gaye. I think in Aretha's case, the same is true. Now, you may not be happy with people trying to sound like Aretha, which is to say, sing with all these great soul riffs, sing emotionally, extravagantly, and so on and so forth. But look at these shows like The Voice. She did open the full floodgates to singers who would take it all the way out. Now, some of them, like Jennifer Hudson, had the chops to do it.
Yes. Not everybody does.
And you go back to Charlie Parker, Sonny Stitt had the chops to play like Bird. In Marvin Gaye's case, let's say D'Angelo or Maxwell, have the chops to be a legitimate heir to the Marvin Gaye tradition. But it takes lots of chops. It takes lots of taste. And ultimately, what Aretha did was set an incredibly high bar. And yet, as much as I love Jennifer Hudson, and I could name, a dozen current female vocalists now who I love, but there's still something about Aretha.
Yeah.
And again, I go back to this combination of joy and pain, praise, and at the same time, abject angst. Mm-hmm. And you put those two things together, man, and it is powerful.
Before we go, I can't imagine that there are people on the planet who have probably listened to Aretha more closely and more widely than you. And I wonder if there is, whether a specific song or a vocal performance, a live performance, that's not kind of in the canon, one of the obvious ones.
Yeah, I've got a whole bunch, but I'll just kind of name you two.
Great.
One is, I think I'm going to mention, is her Skylark, which is a beautiful version of the song, where at the end of it, she jumps octaves, and you just think you're going to, have a heart attack and die. It's so great.
Skylark, oh, I don't know if you can find these things. Oh, but my heart is riding on. So if you see them anywhere, won't you lead me there?
The other, you can go on YouTube, mm-hmm. and this is a weird one, but man, I've just looked at this one 100 times. She does a duet with Tom Jones on the Tom Jones Show. All you got to do is go to YouTube and type in Aretha Franklin, Tom Jones, and they do the standard, the party's over. And it is just beautiful. I mean, he sings his ass off. She, you know, tears it up, and that kills me. So, you know, we all have our little personal things.
Private spots, yeah.
Yeah, but those are a couple of mine, and I could go on and on.
David Ritz, a real titan in the game yourself. I'm grateful for your time today, and thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John.
Before we go this week, I want to add one personal note. I mentioned earlier in the episode that I had seen Aretha last year live. This was on Long Island. It was maybe, I don't know, maybe one of only a handful of shows that she did last year. I went with my mother. My mom has been trying to see Aretha Franklin live for the last couple of years, and there have been a lot of cancellations, and it's been a real challenge to get in a room where Aretha was performing. I had not seen Aretha live prior to that. And if I'm being honest, I don't know if skeptical is the right word, but I was nervous. That would be a troubling experience. I've seen a lot of stars in their later years, and it's been hard. I've written a lot of reviews of people in their declining eras, and it's never an enjoyable thing. But watching Aretha was an entirely different thing. She was vivid. She was alive in the moment. She had both presence of mind, presence of music, and presence of personality that you are familiar with from watching old clips of her, old videos of her. The way that she interacted with the people on stage with her and the way that she interacted with the audience was incredibly sharp and attuned. And I also have rarely seen a performer somehow be completely engaged with everything that's happening around her and also completely above it and almost done with it. And it was a real gift to be able to watch. And also, I have to say, watching my mother kind of come alive in that room, getting a whiff of what Aretha was putting out and absorbing that and seeing what a performer like Aretha could do for my mother was really moving for me personally to watch. And I was and remain incredibly grateful for that experience. That's our show this week. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us any questions or thoughts at podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to the podcast anywhere audio is available. Our producers this week are Nina Patak and Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We'll be back next week.